see him.
But I don't see him.
I don't see him.
He is among the attendees. If we could move Scott Whalen to a panelist.
Oh, thank you.
There we go.
Mr. Whalen, welcome.
Hello, starting video.
Okay, so let me just introduce the item. This is item 8, review total portfolio performance for the period ending December 31st, 2020. The first part will be presentation from Verus. Mr. Whalen.
Thank you very much. So apologize because I feel like I owe you an apology because I had another client meeting this morning and in person, actually, in Visalia, and that's where I am right now. I'm in their executive boardroom, and it ran late. And while I like every single one of my clients to think that they are my only client, I think I failed in both cases today. So I apologize for that. And now I'm shifting gears mentally. So that's my other challenge. So as I come to you for this first agenda item of the two that I have with you, I want to touch base on our investment landscape, review sort of the quarterly economic environment, and then move into your performance. And with that, I'm going to try to share my screen and make sure I pick the right one here. And I'm going to change the view to full screen mode.
You're good.
Okay. Excellent. Wow. Technology two-step. Okay, so I'm gonna take you to kind of this page as a landing point to make some general comments, and then I'll dive into some more specific comments. I want to show you the chart on the lower right-hand portion of this page. The S&P 500 index kind of encapsulates graphically what happened over the last 12 months. So you can see this big drop-off, a big drawdown as we entered into COVID and got more serious in the world started taking it seriously and markets responded through March. And then once we hit bottom, it was a pretty quick and aggressive recovery, right? In about the August timeframe, we saw another dip due to the concerns that, you know, maybe we really weren't going to come out of this thing. There was the second wave that hit and infection rates really ratcheting up pretty aggressively. And then right around here, we got news that there was a vaccine out and that's when markets sort of took off and haven't really looked back up really even through February, the end of February. So in terms of the speed and duration, or sorry, the speed and the impact of this, it was big drop down and then a very quick recovery, which implies that the market is looking past the pandemic, despite the fact that we're not back to where we were pre-pandemic from an economic activity perspective. The markets have fully recovered and even extended a bit. There's been some really interesting reversals through this period. And so I'll talk about those briefly. The first one is a growth value reversal. So growth has been an outperformer for quite some time now. And through the pandemic, it outperformed even more strongly as Zoom and Amazon reflected people's behavioral changes during lockdown. And value, sort of think older economy stocks where you make it, sell and use stuff, really got hammered. That has reversed as optimism about coming out of lockdown has increased. So value is outperformed growth for the first time in a while. Small cap stocks over large cap stocks is another trend that has reversed. If you think through the pandemic, the larger companies with better resources were doing better and small cap stocks were getting hit harder. And that has also reversed in a pretty big way. International over domestic is another interesting one. So the US has handily beaten international stocks really since the global financial crisis, and for a number of reasons, but largely because of our rapid recovery out of the global financial crisis, rapid and ongoing recovery out of the global financial crisis. And then just recently, international stocks have outperformed, sort of led by emerging markets. But if you look at international stocks relative to US stocks recently, they're at about parity in terms of returns if you look at them in their local market currencies, right? If you were a Brit investing in the UK versus an American investing in America, the returns everywhere else besides the US was about equal to the US, but the currency effect really provided a tailwind to international stocks. And then a couple more reversals. Bonds have pulled back as rates have risen through the outlook, looking beyond the pandemic. Rates are rising, indicating, you know, better times ahead and higher economic activity. And then commodities, for a similar reason, have also come back. If you look at commodities and where they've been over the last, 10 years on an average annualized basis, I think negative returns over the last 10 years. And so they are having a bit of a resurgence as oil prices rise, industrial metal prices rise, in anticipation of more economic activity ahead. A number of risks remain. The market is pretty optimistic right now. Risks remain in terms of, are we really out of this pandemic? You know, we've got really good news on the vaccine front, got really good news on the infection rate and hospital bed utilization. But, you know, there's the covariants or the variants out there that are not sure that the vaccine is going to be able to treat those. And will the variants continue to evolve and cause problems in the future? Definitely a risk. You've got geopolitical risks around a more assertive and aggressive China and our desire at this point to stand in front of that assertiveness. And Russia continues to be a pain in our side. You've got the wealth gap that continues to expand. And historically, that has been a long-term problem for ongoing wealth creation. And then you've got this monetary and fiscal policy response, not only to the pandemic, but the monetary response goes all the way back to the global financial crisis and this increasing bill that we're going to have to pay at some point in the future that markets really aren't paying attention to yet. So markets are optimistic, looking past the pandemic, sort of near-term ebullience with intermediate to long-term risks still out there. I'm gonna take you next to slide 7 and just point out the table on the right-hand portion of the page, a couple of points to make there. So this just shows you where we were a year ago across these key economic metrics and where we were at the last print when this report was produced. The GDP print, -2.8%. So you can see reflective of ongoing issues associated with the pandemic. You know, the fourth quarter GDP number was really strong up through the third quarter, strong off the bottom, fourth quarter strong, but leveling off. And so the rapid rate of recovery that we saw through the remainder of 2020, you know, we would expect that to slow down as we get back closer to pre-COVID activity. The inflation rate, lower than it was a year ago, that's crept up a bit, and we would expect the first and second quarter to see sort of a technical bounce, higher inflation, but nothing to be too concerned about. It's a bounce off the bottom, so a base effect there. And then expected inflation rising as well, but also some technical causes there. The Fed was buying TIPS, Treasury Inflation Protected Securities, which have an impact on expected inflation. And they own something like 20% of the market of those securities. So inflation really viewed currently as being pretty well under control. In fact, Chairman Powell made some comments on inflation yesterday saying, yeah, inflation isn't the thing that we're worried about. We're still very interested in being supportive of this economy. Fed funds rate is, as you know, very accommodative, keeping rates very low, at least in the short curve. The 10-year rate, so at the end of the year, was at 0.9. Through the first quarter, it's risen back up. I think it's at about 1.35 now. A year ago, it was at 1.9. In 2018, it was all the way up at 3.25. So we've come down from the most recent cyclical high that we were at, starting to creep back up again. Big question about where the tipping point is, where higher rates cause lower stock prices. And in 2018, you may remember we had that big S&P 500 dip. It got almost into bear market territory. It just fell short of it at a 19% drawdown in the fourth quarter as rates moved above that or that 3% level, and the Fed put in place 4 rate increases when the market was only expecting 3. So equity markets probably still very sensitive to rate rises. And the question remains, how high can rates go before the market, the equity market responds? You know, if rates are rising as economic activity is increasing and earnings are increasing, you're probably in a pretty good place. But if rates are rising in the absence of strong economic activity, you will likely see a pullback. And then unemployment, again, big, strong bounce off the bottom, slower improvement more recently. That 6.7 number comes with an increase in, or a reduction rather, in the employment participation rate. So because of COVID and people being out of work for a long time, they've just decided to stay out of work. And so less people looking for jobs, lower unemployment, but, you know, sort of a headwind to economic activity on a longer term basis. Moving to slide 8, just a couple of points on the pandemic. So, you know, there's been really good news here, and that is you've seen the infection rate, the new infection rate drop pretty substantially. You know, there's a technical issue there that we've got a lower volume of testing being done, speculatively and probably because through the holiday season, more people were going to visit their grandparents. So there were a lot more tests being done, which leads then to a higher incidence of new infections being discovered. But there really is true improvement. And you can understand that when you look at the inpatients in hospitals, that number has dropped from about 20% of hospital beds being taken up by COVID inpatients to about 10%. So significant improvement there. And then we've got the vaccine that's being rolled out, you know, notwithstanding the glitches you hear about in the press and the supply chain challenges caused by the weather, we're up to about 1.6 million doses being administered a day relative to about 200,000 at the beginning of the year. And that continues to improve. So good news on the vaccine front, which really looks like it's having some effect and hopefully getting us back to normal sooner rather than later. I'm gonna move to slide 12. Having a little trouble, a little technical difficulty. I thought I was doing so well. I'm gonna stop sharing for just a moment. Please bear with me. Be right back.
Scott, this is Christina from the office. Did you want us to present it from here and you can tell us what slide to go to?
I think that would be a wonderful backup for sure.
Okay. Okay, we'll start sharing.
Thank you. Mine are not advancing for some reason. I think maybe okay. I think maybe I've overwhelmed my machine.
Thanks, Christina.
Give us a second.
Recovery, I appreciate it.
I'm going to leave all my Visalia jokes out of this.
That's good, because I think they can hear you.
Ooh. That live mic, Candace, caught me there.
I'm curious, they're meeting in person. So masked, 6 feet apart, or do they not believe in COVID, or or how are they doing it?
They never stopped. So they continued to meet in person throughout and are taking the prescribed precautions.
Great. Well, that's great they can do it. And do they have members of the public that often come to their meetings?
Never.
Okay. Well, and that's probably has been one of the biggest obstacles for most of us who are hoping to meet in person sometime. It's just, what do you do with the audience? So anyway, I digress.
I appreciate the digression while we are dealing with technical difficulties. So, okay. So thank you. We're up, we're back and running, it looks like. Thank you very much. Nice recovery. Okay. So the point on inflation is an interesting one, and it's a big point of consideration in our shop, and seems to be a point of speculation in the markets as well. So inflation has not been doing a lot. You look at the break-even inflation rates on the lower right-hand portion of the page, you know, jumped up a little bit in December. I think it's up to 2.3% now, so rising. As I mentioned, there's some technical reasons behind that around Fed intervention, but the big question is the economic dynamics that we're seeing coming out of COVID going to cause any issues with lasting inflation? And that is, you know, you've got people out of work now. Interestingly, the savings rate increased through COVID. People didn't have a lot to spend. Their incomes broadly, right, in aggregate, weren't impacted. You had the checks coming from the federal government. So savings rates increased. you're going to have people going back to work, and you're going to have more stimulus coming. So that's on the demand side, and demand is expected to be strong and healthy. And then on the supply side, you know, you've still got production bottlenecks and constraints due to the fact that the economy has been and continues to be shut down. And those will be coming back online. But the question is, will they come back online before all these dollars go out to buy goods and services? And so there's real concern about potential inflation. And that's why that break-even rate has been moving up. Inflation expectations have been moving up. But Chairman Powell made pretty explicitly clear yesterday that he thinks that any inflationary pressures will be modest and transitory, and he's not worried about it. And so, you know, he's really, I think, going to wait to see the whites of inflation's eyes before he takes any action. So inflation is an interesting story to keep an eye on. On the labor market, on the next slide, I mentioned the labor participation rate, and you can see that in the middle chart there. So labor participation sort of fell off a cliff, as you would expect through the pandemic, but it has sort of paused, and we believe that there will be a labor participation rate impact out into the future, sort of constraining the economy's ability to grow past getting back to normal. Another point on unemployment conditions I'll show on slide 15, I think just as a point of interest. The chart on the upper left-hand portion of this page shows fourth quarter non-farm payroll changes. And, you know, this is shows in graphical form something you probably all understand intuitively, and that's where most of the pain is coming through the pandemic and who's suffering the most. You can see the professional and business services up at the top came back strong and really never had the same problems that folks down at the bottom in the leisure and hospitality industry had. So it's really leisure and hospitality and the service sectors that got hit the most. That government bar there is a little bit of an anomaly or a false flag in that that's the census workers that came off government payroll when that job was done. The next slide I'll show is on slide 18 and talk about housing. And you can see here, again, perhaps intuitive, just based on what you've been hearing in the financial press and seeing yourselves in the markets, is housing affordability has increased and is pretty high relative to history. And that's all about the low mortgage rates that you see in that center chart, right? So historically low, bottom of the barrel mortgage rates, making mortgages really cheap, causing housing prices and housing sales to do pretty well. You can see in the lower left-hand portion of the page there. So housing being a real bright spot in the economy. On the next slide, on slide 19, international economics, a real difference here between the US and much of the rest of the developed world. You can see the key indicators there, GDP, inflation, and unemployment. GDP falling the least in the US. And then looking down in the emerging market nations, China really driving the tail wagging the dog there. As you know, they locked down early and severely and purportedly got a handle on the pandemic and then opened back up earlier than everybody else. And it shows in their actual growth numbers. With that, I will take you to slide 22. Just give you a sense of the interest rate environment.
Hey, Scott.
So, please.
I had a question about the evidence that is tacked back to China. Do we have any sense of how transparent that data is as to its sources? I mean, there's a lot of reticence to believe everything you read and hear in terms of that. So do you have a sense of the reliability of that info?
So it's always a question when dealing with a command economy, right? And China in particular. And so the data that I showed is always a little suspect because the source is government produced data, government produced and reported data. But, analysts being the clever folks that they are, they try and look at it through another lens to validate. And so they look at things like power usage. They look at, satellite photos of light. They look at Google Maps movement patterns. And so they can't corroborate what the government is putting out, but they can see that it's directionally correct.
Got it. Thank you. It's helpful.
Okay. So on slide 22, thank you. You can see interest rates, short-term, and then the 10-year government rate for each of these countries. It's interesting to still see negative numbers, largely across the board. Those rates have moved up pretty significantly from, I'm looking at the 10-year now, pretty significantly from those very low numbers. And I'll just sort of go down the list with the current numbers. The US, as I mentioned, is at 1.35 versus that 0.91. Germany's at negative 0.34. France, it's still negative, barely at negative 0.09. Spain's moved up to 0.32. Italy, about the same at 0.6. And Greece, UK, Japan, all of them have moved up off of the bottom. So rates are rising around the globe. As I mentioned, the question is when and if do those rising rates have an impact on risk assets like equities? I want to take you to the equity environment on slide 27. And here I'm just going to make the point that I commented on earlier about the currencies having a big impact on international equity returns. So if you look at that, just look at the international large shaded box there, sort of in the middle of the table on the right, and looking at the first column, quarter to date total return, unhedged and hedged. So the hedged return is 11.9%. That would be a US investor investing in European markets, international developed markets, I should say, in dollars, hedging back to dollars. So you're just getting that local return, 11.9%. And then the unhedged return is 16%, which really indicates a big decline in, a big impact of the decline in the dollar. And if you look at that 11.9% and then go up to the top of that same column relative to the US S&P 500 at 12.1%, right? They sort of returned about the same, if not for that currency effect. So good tailwind to international. Your international investments benefited from that currency effect, and international just did quite well. Looking at the next slide, we can see the chart on the lower right-hand portion of the page where in the quarter, where the performance came from across sectors. And you look at the top four returning sectors, and it's all sort of old economy, brick and mortar sectors anticipating reopening and doing quite well because of it. And then you look at the very bottom in real estate, and it probably shouldn't be a big surprise that real estate is the worst performing sector, given that people are still trying to figure out what the real estate market, shopping, going to the office, where you're going to live, all those things are still big open questions as people figure that out following the pandemic. And then an interesting point on the chart in the middle of the page, you look at the dividend yield of stocks versus the bond yield. I think you guys can probably see the color difference there. We should probably do a better job of differentiating, but the dark blue that trails down to the right is the US 10-year bond yield. So 10-year treasury yield. And as you would expect, it's come down pretty steadily and significantly back since the 80s. And then the S&P 500 dividend yield, which has come down a little bit, but remained largely stable over that time period. The interesting point is at the end of those two lines, you see that the 10-year treasury yield at now 1.35 is below the stock dividend yield. So what this, you may have heard the phrase, the Tina trade, there is no alternative to stocks or risk assets. So you can't expect people to pile into bonds when they're getting more dividend yield from stocks than bonds. And so people continue to see stocks as an attractive alternative despite the risk, because there's really no place else to go for return. And equity valuations on slide 33. So this is really interesting, but I'm gonna really just use this page as a landing point to make some comments that aren't really reflected on this page. Back in May, we did some analysis internally to try and get a sense of the appropriate value for US stocks proxied by the S&P 500. And so we made some assumptions about earnings that were really, consensus analyst assumptions. And then we made some assumptions about the recovery and when that would happen. And then we used sort of normalized pre-pandemic interest rates. And what we found based on those assumptions were that the S&P 500 at that time should have been about 2950. It's now at 3900. So back in May, the outlook was really dire and people were saying, gosh, we're going to have a 50% earnings recession and then maybe we'll normalize after a couple of years and move ahead at a, you know, slow, normal pace from there. What we got was a very mild earnings recession. Earnings were down 10% in 2020 versus the anticipated 50%. So it was nowhere near the global financial crisis where people were concerned about in the beginning. And now people, the consensus estimate for 2021 earnings is 23.6% growth. So short, small dip, strong ongoing recovery. So when we put those assumptions into our model, along with the additional assumptions that interest rates will stay or about where they are now going forward, we get an S&P 500 number of about 3,700, which is close to, below, but close to the current market valuation of 3,900. So when people talk about, you know, the market being overvalued, I always tend to think it is, even though I'm an optimistic person. But when people get concerned about the market being hugely overvalued in this rate environment, with the way that earnings are expected to perform, it's, you know, maybe it's 5% off its current valuation based on that back of the envelope calculation. So just a little bit on valuation there. And then lastly, you'll probably be happy that I'm taking a breath on slide 45. You know, I like to show this slide every time I come talk to you guys about the economic landscape. This is an historical chart of pretty much every asset class out there that you can think of on the public side, public markets, and goes back 10 years. So we've got domestic equity, fixed income, international equity, and a list of others. And the points that I want to make here really highlight the trend reversals that I talked about at the very beginning of my comments. And if you just draw your attention, and this is where I wish I had my cursor, but if you draw your attention to the upper left-hand portion of the page, the S&P 500, the top line, the 10-year column. So that 13.9, wow, that's good cursor work there, thank you. And then 13.9, relative to where we've been historically is really strong, right? And so that 10-year number is strong relative to longer term history, which you'd expect to be about 9 to 10, but really strong relative to the global financial crisis, where after that, you know, the 10-year historical number was zero. So good, strong recovery out of the global financial crisis and the pandemic. Over the last 10 years, almost 14% in domestic equity markets is just good, a good number. And then, so draw your cursor down to the bottom portion of that chart with a style index, and you look at the first two numbers there, 17.2 versus 10.5. And so that reflects the growth value, outperformance of growth over value over the last 10 years, which is pretty stark, pretty significant, especially when value is supposed to outperform growth because of its higher risk. And theoretically, value should outperform growth over the long term. And then take the cursor over to that quarter to date column on the left-hand portion of that chart. And then you can see how that reversed as optimism over coming out of the pandemic have sort of lit a fire under those financials, industrials, energy, materials, the value stocks. Despite the fact that tech stocks have continued to do well, value stocks have moved ahead. Now, if you just look up a little bit on that same column to the Russell 2000 and the Russell 1000, so you can see how Russell 2000 small caps have really outperformed Russell 1000 large caps for similar reasons, looking out past the pandemic. And then going over to the right, the 10-year column, you can see that over 10 years, large caps have outperformed small cap stocks pretty handily, and an occurrence that's not supposed to happen theoretically because there's more risk in small cap stocks than large cap stocks. And then a couple other trend reversals. So now let's look at that 10-year number at the top of the page, the 13.9, and trace your finger down to the next table, second row, 4.9, right? So the 13.9 is US stocks. The 4.9 is international stocks, everything but the US. So it includes developed markets, emerging markets, all around the world except the US. And you can see how US has just dominated for the past 10 years, 900 basis points, 9 percentage points per year over 10 years is crazy. And then you look at the, go over to the quarter to date column and look at those same numbers, 12%, so strong for the S&P, but 17% for international. As I mentioned, a large part of that is due to the currency effect, but still strong nonetheless, where it's been a trailer, a laggard for so many years. And then you look just down a couple of rows to the MSCI EM or emerging markets, and emerging markets have done even better. Lastly, well, two things actually. Next to lastly, I'll take you to the chart on the upper right hand portion of the page, looking at bonds right in the middle of the page. There's that the row, the Treasury long index. So government bonds, just the rate impact. You can see over the long term, as rates have come down historically, you've had really strong returns here. And then recently, as rates have backed up, you can see the impact on rising rates on the Treasury long bond. So negative returns coming off of a really strong year where returns fell significantly because of the pandemic. And lastly, the Bloomberg Commodity Index in the first row in the next table down. And so here's where I mentioned that commodities have been horrible for 10 years, have finally gotten a little wind at their back because of anticipation and actual opening of the economy. And then, you know, also some OPEC impact on oil prices, but also industrial metals as China has ramped up production and the expectation of further production and economic activity increases to come. And with that, I will take a breath and pause and see if there are any questions or comments before moving to performance. Where are you guys at?
Not seeing any mics light up.
Okay, just a quickie. Thanks for the comprehensive overview there, Scott. Appreciate it.
Pleasure.
Actually, two quick questions. One, we had a presentation a while ago on, I think it was currency hedging. And so it was interesting when you were talking about the hedged and unhedged returns to international, I think it was international equity. Is that still an item, kind of a topic being researched for the plan?
So is that question posed to me or I guess to Tim about topics planned for research?
Well, gosh, either.
So Jay, this is Tim. I think, you know, the presentation at the time was, you know, received and we acknowledge that this was a risk that was in our asset allocation and there was no action taken at that time. So it was essentially shelved. And when we did the asset allocation review last year, I think most everything we took a look at was the international equity and emerging market asset classes on an unhedged basis. So we have been moving forward with the expectation that we will remain unhedged on a policy level basis. Now, individual managers can put hedges on. They do so infrequently, but on a policy level, I think that's something we've deferred for now.
Okay, great. Thanks for the update. And back, I guess, to a little bit more recently, we just did the changing of the liquidity term and kind of whole asset allocation project. Given kind of the update here, was there anything that you think would prompt a change in or a revisiting of that asset allocation or the kind of even the timing of implementation there?
No.
Perfect. Short answer. I like it. Thank you.
Short question, short answer. And thanks for the question. Okay. So notwithstanding any additional questions or comments, I will happily return to the portfolio review on slide 2 of the next section. So if you could just scroll down a few pages and you can look at the numbers. There you go. Thank you. Perfect. So really good news here. You know, at least in hindsight, looking in the rearview mirror, you look at the last 3 months and the year to date in the table on the top of the page, you can see started the quarter with $9.5 billion, net cash outflow of about $100 million, big investment increase, and ending up above $10 billion. Similar numbers. You look at the year to date, and you can see the big impact that the fourth quarter had in your overall 1 year number. So it was a matter of sort of slow climb and then good market recovery in the fourth quarter, and getting you to that same ending point. I'll take you to slide 4, asset allocation. And so your current allocation relative to your long-term policy, the two bar charts, stacked bar charts on the right, you can see that the slow and methodical transition to the long-term policy continues. You got a little bit of an underweight to growth, and that will continue to get remediated as you build out your private markets program and leg into that to maintain vintage year diversification across private asset classes. And then a little bit of an overweight to liquidity as you're moving down to the new liquidity target that was just mentioned, and diversifying. A little bit of an underweight there with some cash in the portfolio that is attributed to cash in the overlay that Tim mentioned. Looking at high level composite performance on the next slide, you can see that for the quarter, the total fund came in net of fees just over the benchmark at 8.2%, the 1 year number at 9.2%. That being largely attributable to impacts that we've talked about before in the diversifying portfolio and then in the growth portfolio as well. Part of that being a benchmarking issue that we're gonna talk about in the next agenda item, and the liquidity portfolio being right on top of its benchmark as you would expect given the short-term low-risk nature of those assets. Now, I wanna draw your attention to slide 7. And this is an important chart that I like to show to demonstrate that you're meeting expectations of the investment strategy. So this is 3 and 5 year risk return charts. They're very similar. So I'll just point to the 3 year chart, and you can see where you are. You're reflected by you're represented by the black diamond, which is your policy index, and the red square, which is your actual fund experience relative to the 67 portfolios in your universe. And so you can see there that you are to the left of the median with respect to risk and right on the median from a policy index perspective with respect to return. So the strategy is doing what it's expected to be doing and providing a good amount of return for less risk. And the total fund being just below the policy index is due to areas that we've covered over time. And then the Sharpe ratio, you look at that 0.67 and you're in a really strong Sharpe ratio position and, you know, just good efficient portfolio. So the functionally focused portfolio is acting as you would expect from a risk and return perspective. And then we move to a more granular look at performance on the next slide. And we can see how y'all did over the quarter and just hitting on a few of the your individual managers and making a couple of comments. You know, no real huge outliers. This is gross of fees, so you can see that you get an, that 8.3% versus 8.1. You are in the 89th percentile for the quarter relative to peers, and I think you all are very aware that in strong rising markets, based on your risk portfolio, particularly as you build out that the growth sleeve of your portfolio, you will struggle to keep up and you will protect very well in downturns. And then you look at, into the growth portfolio itself, and you can see that you're for the quarter about 30 basis points behind at that composite level. Domestic equity did quite well. You can look down at some of the contributors. Jackson Square Partners did well, and you know, for managers do well and poorly in any given quarter for variable reasons. These guys were overweight and had good selection in IT stocks, which helped during the quarter. Boston Partners did quite well, a couple hundred basis points. You can see their rankings, both of those managers. Boston Partners had good selection in healthcare and in IT and in energy, and they happen to be overweight in financial services that helped this quarter, and they were underweight in consumer staples and utilities. And then I'll take you to the next slide and pick out a couple of managers there to comment on. You can see Pierford was an underperformer for the quarter, 11.3 versus 20.4, but that didn't impact their one-year number. If you just look one column to the right, a very strong performer for the 1 year. You know, they had difficulty with selection in the Eurozone. They were overweight in Switzerland.
Time out for just a second. I think we're supposed to be on slide 9, staff.
Yes, sir. Sorry, should have mentioned that. Thanks for bringing that up. And so they had some currency issues in Sweden and Hong Kong and Taiwan as well. So sort of a aggregation of headwinds impacted their portfolio for the quarter. But as I mentioned, their one-year number remains strong relative to the benchmark and peers. And then one nice change, it was good to see PIMCO, as would be expected. PIMCO's research affiliate strategy in the emerging markets outperformed 26.5 versus 23%, and largely the result of natural overweights relative to their strategy, overweight in materials and consumer discretionary, particularly in auto there. So good performance there. And TT emerging markets had good, strong performance. So a number of good, solid performers across the your equity managers. So the one thing that I want to bring your attention to if I can find it.
Can I ask you a quick question, Scott?
Please do.
Looking at gross of fees, I mean, that's not our real return. So we use gross of fees with respect to comparison to the benchmarks.
So it's a good question. So we use gross of fees and net of fees. With gross of fees, we look at gross of fees primarily to show the universe ranking. So you'll notice in the gross of fee pages, you have that universe ranking included. The net of fee pages, which are back a few pages, you have net of fees, and that only shows comparisons to the benchmarks. So I land on the gross of fee pages just because it shows everything on a single page. But you're right, sort of mentally, the mental calculation is there's fees that come out of that.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. And, you know, I think we've actually gotten to a point or are getting to a point where we now have robust net of fee universes. So it's something that you may see change in the future where you can have net of fee for the entire comparative suite, which will be a good thing. So page 10 is the other point that I wanted to make, and that is around your risk parity allocation. And, you know, risk parity is, I think, is a good long-term strategy. It's been very efficient in terms of applying its risk to get its return. You can see underperformance here relative to the chosen benchmark, which is a 60-40 portfolio, a global 60-40 portfolio, and it's struggled. Commodities comes into play there, although I don't think AQR has commodities in their portfolio. But, you know, the real question is strategically, is this something that we want to continue with? And, you know, I bring this up just as a bit of foreshadowing on something that staff is looking at, because what this is a levered bond portfolio. It's a levered portfolio with heavy bond, heavy interest rate risk embedded in it in an historically low interest rate environment. So something that staff and we are thinking about, and potentially more to come on that. And with that, I will conclude my comments. Leave it open to questions or additional comments.
Anyone have anything for Scott before we turn it over to Tim? Not hearing anything, Scott, so thank you. And we'll turn the floor over to Tim.
Thank you. All right, we have camera that's working for the moment. We'll see how long that lasts here. Let me go ahead and share my screen. Bear with me one moment. There we go. So what we have here is the investment staff report that accompanies the consultant's quarterly report. And just again, as a reminder, this report answers a slightly different question than what the consultant report does. Here, we're looking at each one of our functional sub-portfolios relative to a simple investable benchmark and relative to the time frame that we measure the function over. So this gets into a little bit of, you know, did the complexity work for us? And are the functions that we asked for the portfolios to fulfill, are they being fulfilled? Big picture, while the total fund maintains its risk-adjusted premium relative to the simple target index, we have had some more challenges over shorter time periods here, largely due to the fact that public markets have just massively outperformed private markets. And secondarily, because we have a small cap and emerging market bias to some of our public market exposure. But I think that the fact that public markets have just had an enormous year in 2020 relative to what we saw in private equity, private credit, and certainly within real estate is the bigger story here. So let me take you to page 3. We can just take a look at our scorecard here. Liquidity, everything is working as expected. The quality is being maintained. The duration is being maintained. It's got the appropriate size, and that'll be running off over from now until July when we go to our new 3-year target in liquidity. Growth, while from an absolute return perspective, we're having our returns expectations met. We do see that lag relative to the All Country World Index. So this is basically all stock markets around the world there. And again, you know, the private market drag, where we saw, you know, more modest returns from private equity. I think we're up about 4% on the year in private credit. We're down roughly 6% within real estate. relative to an all public equity benchmark has been a drag there. So you would say over this particular period, has complexity been rewarded? Not over this five-year snapshot. But from an efficiency standpoint, on a Sharpe ratio basis, we still have a Sharpe ratio for just for our growth portfolio that's superior to the MSCI ACWI. So we're getting what we expected there. And then risk diversifying, which you know has been the trouble spot for the past year. And really, let me take you through kind of a quarter or a dissection of 2020 into a tale of two markets. When we took a look at that first category of wanting a low correlation to the growth portfolio, we saw the correlation spike during the first quarter. And that was largely due to the parametric volatility risk premium strategy, which you know, candidly did not perform as expected during that time period. Everything else kind of worked to varying degrees, but the drag from the parametric portfolio pushed our volatility up in the first quarter, and we're still, you know, that number is still heavily impacting the trailing five-year period. And then on the positive real returns, this has been an area where we've been considerably below. We're clawing our way back. This is an improving trend line here. So while it's on a real basis, net of inflation, we're not yet in positive territory. This has been an improving trend line here. And we think the additions, the changes that we've made to the program over the past year with the termination of Wellington, the reduction in size of Parametric, the addition of Acadian, today's earlier approval of the SIT strategy pushes in a better direction there. But certainly, I don't want to sugarcoat it, that program has not worked over the past 5 years the way we expected it to. A little bit of a deeper dive. Oh, well, before I do that. So when we put everything up to the total fund level, we say, you know, most everything is meeting expectations. It's really just that offset to the growth volatility that needs some additional work there. And that has been the primary area of focus for my team for the past, on the public side for the past year. If we move to a little bit deeper dive on the liquidity sub portfolio. Everything's generally going well here. Nothing major to report on that front. If we move to page 5 on the growth sub portfolio, I do think it's interesting just to take a look at the 1 year firm asset growth. And if you take a look at value oriented shops versus growth oriented shops, certainly the performance differential that Scott highlighted is evident here, but I think you start to see some investor flows as well. So somebody like Boston Partners, which is largely a value-oriented shop, overall firm asset growth down 14%. If you take a look at somebody like Jackson Square, which is largely a growth-oriented shop, up 26%. We're also seeing that within some of the real estate segments. So Adelante, within that REIT space, the publicly traded real estate security space, also down 27% on a firm-wide basis over the past year. And then the other thing to note would be quantitatively oriented firms had a tough 2019 and 2020. You started to see that show up in some investor flows. So we do note that AQR and Panagora both saw firm-wide asset declines in the year. Nothing that's going to change our baseline assessments of the, you know, the going concern aspects of the firms, but it's something to be noted. We did see the reversal start to show up in the fourth quarter. We are still seeing that reversal continue in the first quarter. So we expect to see some normalization, but the discrete calendar year 2020 does show these patterns here. On page 6, again, in the growth portfolio, we tend to focus on a 5 year plus time frame. So if you take a look at those 5 year returns, most asset classes are delivering the high single digits to low double digits returns that we would expect. You know, I think when we get to Adelante in the REIT space in general has been a little bit of a challenge just based upon where real estate has been in the past year. And Allianz in the high yield space, you know, a little bit lower than we would expect, but not significantly. The real story is those bottom three rows: private equity, private credit, and real estate. And the five-year premium there is the five-year premium relative to a public market benchmark. So in this case, we're seeing all three of those private market allocations underperform the MSCI ACWI benchmark over the trailing five-year period. Not what we expect to see, not what we want to see, but over this time period, with the, you know, with the type of year we saw in 2020, I think, you know, we are looking closely at the private equity and private credit space as having come through quite well from an operational and fundamentals basis, but we haven't seen valuations pop back up, except for venture capital, which is a very small portion of our overall program. And then real estate, I think we just have a lot of question marks in terms of when we get to a normalized real estate environment, what's that going to look like? We still have, concerns about multifamily usage and rates there. The question mark around office remains, rent collections have remained extremely strong. But I think as we start to see some leases roll off in 2021, there'll be some question marks around renewal rates and what we see there. So I'd say in private equity and private credit, we're satisfied with the performance and we're hoping to see valuations pick up. Real estate, we have some significant questions and we're in pretty heavy dialogue with our partners in that space to try and understand where we're going to see some challenges and where there might be some opportunities to deploy additional capital over the next 2 years or so there. Page 8 on the risk diversifying sub portfolio, we see the challenges there with Parametric with the 1 year correlation, spiking up to 0.9 and some underperformance there. AFL-CIO, while having a difficult fourth quarter, had a good 2020 year. And Acadian is just up and running. So what you're seeing here is Acadian's strategy over a full year, but we've only had them funded for about 5 months or so as of the end of the year. One thing I did want to note is that Parametric is owned by Eaton Vance. Eaton Vance is in the process of being acquired by Morgan Stanley. As part of that process, or at least coincidentally with that process, the portfolio manager for our strategy, Jay Strohmeyer, has announced his retirement at the end of March. He's going to be succeeded by Alex Zwaver. We have met with Alex. We have some more meetings scheduled with Alex. It's a very systematic process. So normally in a case like this, we wouldn't expect there to be a direct impact on the strategy as implemented today. The question mark will be whether Alex brings any changes to the implementation. And that's what we'll be watching there. And so I'll just wrap it up on 9 and 10 for a total fund level. This is our upside downside capture ratio versus the simple index over rolling 5 year periods. We are maintaining that spread of capturing less of the downside and more of the upside. The spread has narrowed. That is an area of concern for us. But I think given the unique circumstances of the past year, we're taking that with a little bit of a grain of salt and trying to understand what the drivers are there and whether it's changing our going in assumptions. As you heard from Scott, it's not really changing how we're thinking about strategic asset allocation, but it's just a noteworthy point there. And then on page 10, for the quarter, on the attribution analysis on that top table, really the underperformance of a diversified growth portfolio relative to a public equity portfolio was the story of the quarter. Everything else worked fairly well. And over trailing time periods, while our returns over the 1 through 5 year period are below the simple target index, the efficiency or the Sharpe ratio has been above the simple target index. So while we've been lagging a bit on performance, we've been matching or exceeding on a Sharpe ratio basis. And I'll pause there to see if there's any questions from the trustees.
Tim, thanks, Tim. Thank you.
Great. Thank you.